Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us today. And let's start with our day in history, this day on August the 6th, before we jump into our conversation. This day on August the 6th, many things occurred. People like Lucille Ball were born in 1911, one of the funniest women ever in U.S. Comedic history. This is the day that Robert Mitchum was born in 1917, great actor who lived and died here in the state of Maryland, one of my favorite directors. And Night Shyamalan was born in 1970 here on this day. This is the day in 1623 that Anne Hathaway, the wife of William Shakespeare, passed away, as did the dictator overthrown by Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, and Fulgencio Batista died in 1973. Rick James passed away in 2004. So on this day in history, many things did occur. This was the day that in Baltimore, a man named Samuel Edding in 1847 passed away at the age of 83. His quote was that Maryland has a ban on non-Christians holding office or practicing law. And from 1797, Edding campaigned persistently to have this overturned. He succeeded in 1826 and was the first non-Christian elected to the Baltimore City Council in that year of 1826. He was Jewish. There were 6,000 Jews in the city at that time, and he fought to overturn that law. This was also the day that Congress freed slaves who were forced to fight against the United States by the rebel South in 1861. Interesting juxtaposition here. Given our conversation today is about the Voting Rights Bill, which was signed on this day in 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson. This was also the day in 1870 when white conservatives suppressed the black vote and captured the Tennessee legislature, effectively ending Reconstruction in that state and in North Carolina as well. This is an interesting kind of juxtaposition of times and days, though the violence was intense then, with assassinations and black folks and white allies being killed across the South. This was also the day in 1941 when black and white soldiers were killed in struggles on a bus in North Carolina. Many African-American officers and soldiers were killed during those beginning years of the war. Racial incidents were abound. This first major one concurred in 1941. In North Carolina on a bus going through the South. This was the day in 1945 that the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. This is also the day in 1960 the Cubans nationalized all foreign-owned and American property in Cuba. This is the day in 1962 that Jamaica became independent. And this is the day in 2013 we're going to discuss the Voting Rights Act. We have with us here Ari Berman, who is contributing writer for The Nation magazine, investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, and Michael Higginbotham, who is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, and Addison Francois, Associate Professor of Law at Howard University School of Law, and Sherilyn Eiffel, who is President and Director of Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome all. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Folks, join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or jump onto our Facebook pages and we'll look at your comments there. 410-319-8888. Momentous time 48 years ago and just a few months ago around the Voting Rights Act. And let me just add, we'll talk about next hour. This is also the birthday of Abby Lincoln. We'll be hearing her music during the course of the next 2 hours. Sherilyn Eiffel, thank you for joining us. I know that you only have a brief amount of time for this conversation, so let me start with you. In just the juxtaposition of these days, when we look at this was the beginning of the end of Reconstruction and destroying voting rights for African Americans in 1870. It was a time when Voting Rights Bill was passed 48 years ago and signed by Lyndon Baines Johnson, and we're just months after the moment when the bill literally was gutted by the Supreme Court. So I'm curious, especially in your position now, what comes next? What is the strategy for voting rights in the 21st century? What do people begin to do?
Well, I want to thank so much for having me on, Mark, and I'm so glad you all are celebrating National Voting Rights Day. One of the things we're asking people to do is to really recognize this day as an important day for democracy and action and mobilization. I've been asking people to call their Congress people today to demand that they fix the Voting Rights Act and also to ask people to begin preparing to participate in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. We are using that day as a mobilization day for voting rights, because we're asking Congress to fix the Voting Rights Act in response to the Supreme Court's decision in the Shelby County case. And I actually want to take a little bit issue with the way you describe the Supreme Court's decision, Mark.
Sure.
Because they have not gutted the Voting Rights Act. They did gut Section 5 of the Act by essentially removing the formula used to determine which states were required to submit their voting changes to the Department of Justice before implementation. It was a huge blow. I think a terrible decision, and one that we think Congress has to fix and correct, and one that's left us in the position of having to rely on people in the community to let us know what kind of mischief officials are up to in terms of closing polling places and early voting and purges and so forth. And so I don't want to minimize what the decision did, but the Voting Rights Act has lots of different provisions. One of them is Section 2, which is the provision which allows you to sue if there is a discriminatory law. And I started my career as a voting rights attorney bringing cases under Section 2. It remains alive and strong. Section 3 remains alive and strong, and you may have seen that the Department of Justice and Eric Holder filed a statement of interest in a Texas redistricting case brought under Section 2, demanding that Texas be subject to the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act. In other words, basically recreating the same Section 5 regime that the Supreme Court struck down in terms of the formula, but recreating it as a remedy for a Section 2 violation, which the Voting Rights Act does provide, can happen. So there's a lot still to be done with the Voting Rights Act. There's a lot still to be done with the National Voter Registration Act from 1994, that's known as the Motor Voter Law, which many states are not enforcing. They're not ensuring that voter registration is happening in the Motor Vehicle Bureau and in all the social service agencies, welfare offices, and so forth. So there's a lot to do around voting, a lot of mobilization that needs to happen. No question Congress needs to fix the Supreme Court's decision in terms of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. But this is a time to move forward. And despite all the setbacks, and there always are setbacks, you know this, Mark, this is the organism of civil rights activism. You know, it is the handcrafting and advancement of democracy. And so it steadily goes forward, but you always also, you know, get pushback. And you have to remain resolute and strong and understand there are no permanent wins, not in court, not even in the narrative, in the story of civil rights. You know, you see how much people on the right have taken our words, have co-opted the lexicon, have tried to shift the narrative, you know, about voting and democracy into one about fraud. And so, you know, you have to be ever vigilant, and we are. So that's the strategy going forward is we took a punch, but we can take a punch, and we come out fighting, and we keep pressing forward. We're not trying to get back to the status quo. We're actually trying to advance past where we were by ensuring that the franchise is free, open, and available to everyone.
So very quickly, Sherilyn, before I turn to the other guests, when you raise the issue of Article 2, and I'm going to come to other guests in just
two,
a minute.
Section 2.
I mean Section 2, excuse me. Thank you very much. Section 2. Does that mean that under Section 2, organizations like yours and others could sue around issues around voter ID laws that are passed, about restricting the ability to go and be able to register to vote because they've taken away the right in a certain county and moved it hundreds of miles away?
Yeah, but of course, you can, but of course you can tell what the problem is, right? I mean, the reason we needed Section 5 is because, A, it didn't involve a costly and time-consuming lawsuit. So in order for us to do that, we have to have the resources to file these lawsuits, and we won't be able to file them everywhere. And, I mean, imagine it's a polling place change, right? It's changed, let's say, 3 weeks before an election. We can go in and sue, but unless we can get an injunction to stop the change goes forth while the suit happens. And Section 2 suits can sometimes take years, right? Even if you sue on a, you know, that a redistricting plan, for example, is illegal because it removed, you know, a seat that allows blacks to be able to elect their representative, the election goes forward. Even if years later you win that suit, the person who won under that discriminatory scheme has now all the benefits of incumbency, right? Because they've been in office, they've got the war chest. It's very hard to fully unring the bell of discriminatory elections. And that's why we need a mechanism, and that's why we need Congress to move on changing a new way that will cover jurisdictions under Section 5 so that we can still have a regime that allows us to stop something before it happens. That's what Section 5 did. You had to submit that polling place change to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice could then say, wait a minute, this has a negative effect on minority voters. We do not give you approval to move that polling place. And that was the enormous advantage. That was the incredible power of Section 5 that the Supreme Court did strike down.
So, Ari Berman, talk for a minute about how you, as you write about this across the nation, how this this Supreme Court decision has changed the nature of voting rights in specific states, and what you see as struggles to stand up against that.
Sure. Well, in many ways, this is a sad and in some ways tragic anniversary because we're celebrating a law that is greatly weakened compared to even how things were 2 months ago. And even then, as Sherilyn mentioned, there were a lot of problems in voting rights that even the Voting Rights Act didn't address. So since the decision itself, we've had six southern states rush to implement or pass new voting restrictions. North Carolina just passed the country's worst voter suppression law. I'm pretty confident that North Carolina Republicans made that law so onerous because they knew they wouldn't have to pre-clear it with the Department of Justice. If Section 5 had still been around, I think we would have seen a much more temperate version of that legislation. But even before this new round of voter suppression in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision, we saw this unbelievable attack on the right to vote following Obama's election. Once Republicans got control of all these state legislatures in 2010, they introduced 180 bills restricting voting rights in 41 states. And we saw all sorts of states, whether it was Wisconsin or Florida or Pennsylvania or Ohio or Texas, rushing to implement new voting restrictions in a way that was really reminiscent of the pre-Voting Rights Act era. And so for the last 3 years, we've just been dealing with this unbelievable acceleration of attacks on the right to vote, where one party has decided they're going to try to win elections by making it harder for those who disagree with them to be able to vote. And so we're in a situation where not only does the Congress really need to address the Voting Rights Act, but they have to do a lot more to give federal protections to people, because right now they're facing it from so many angles, whether it's mandating an ID that they never needed before or cutting back early voting, which is leading to the long lines we saw in Florida, or eliminating things like same-day registration that just make it so much easier to show up, register, and vote, or preventing ex-felons who have already served their time from being able to cast a ballot, or purging the voter rolls in a way that targets people of color. There's so many different angles that the right to vote is being attacked under, that these anniversaries of things like the VRA and so are so important because they draw public attention to the need that these fights aren't over. In many ways, they're beginning anew.
So let me go turn to, before I know, Sherilyn, you only have a few minutes left for this, but I do want to get to Addison and Michael real quickly here, and then before we come back to you, before you have to go. But Addison, I wonder, again, as another professor of law looking at the Voting Rights Act, I mean, beyond that, where do you see this taking us? I mean, what's your assessment of where this takes us?
Well, I agree that we have to be sort of optimistic in terms of looking forward. I do think, however, that it's helpful to be plain as to the challenges that we face. And I would mention two things. Number one, and I think some of your guests have already mentioned this, what the Supreme Court decision has done is to essentially taken us through pre-Section 5 era, roughly the era between 1957 and 1965. What we sometimes forget is that there was a voting rights law in the book starting in 1957, wasn't very effective, but there was quite a bit of litigation that took place around it. And what happened during those eras is what I call the sort of whack-a-mole era, where essentially every single time the Supreme Court would strike down a particular tactic in the South that used to deny blacks the right to vote, they would come up with something new. In fact, it is the very reason why Section 5 was passed. The second thing I want to mention, I think your guests already alluded to it, is that the problem that I see with what's happening in Texas right now, specifically the bail-in provision of Section 3, where instead of the jurisdiction being automatically subject to preclearance, we have to sort of get them to be subject to preclearance, is that it begins to be a very political process. For example, it is very, very difficult to imagine that had Section 4 been validated under the administration of former President George W. Bush, that the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, would have pushed to have Texas bill in. It wouldn't have happened. So what we found ourselves now in the position is that if we have to rely on Section 2, it means, as Cheryl mentioned before, it's subject to a very expensive and time-consuming and sometimes ineffective litigation. Moreover, if we have to rely on Section 3, it means that it becomes a very political process whereby the extent to which we enforce voting rights depends on who happens to be in power. And I think, to be honest, is a very, very difficult position for us to be in.
Michael, your thoughts before we turn back to Sherilyn?
Well, I think we need a comprehensive approach in response to this Shelby County decision. No question that voting rights are under attack these days. And with voter ID laws, with limitations on early voting, and with racial gerrymandering, we need to really have a comprehensive response. And that means Congress updating the formula. It's not a 13-state problem. It's a 50-state problem. Congress needs to respond to Justice Roberts' opinion in Shelby, update the formula, and they need to identify the practices that are going on today and make it clear that there is a similar impact and a similar intent to the practices that went on during Jim Crow. And once a comprehensive response is made, then I think that voting rights can be restored.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on voting rights and where we go from here. And let me shift this discussion a minute to kind of a political question. And Cheryl, before you have to go, I want to kind of throw this out to you first. The Voting Rights Act, it took a civil war to get us to the 15th Amendment and the battle around Reconstruction. It took a civil rights movement organizing people throughout the South and allies in the North to create the Voting Rights Act. It really does take a movement to make this change. The question is, what do you see is going on beyond the legal movements that are taking place and the considerations of groups like yours at the moment, the Legal Defense Fund? What it takes to really challenge this Voting Rights Act in America? You have so many states in the United States right now that 24 voting restrictions were passed in 17 states that were really horrendous. But five battleground states that can decide an election have really tightened their voting laws to places where it makes it very difficult. It will diminish people of color and working people from voting. So, I mean, it does take a movement. It takes more than a march on Washington on the 24th. How do you see that growing?
Well, that's what's so exciting about this particular time, Mark. I mean, it's quite interesting. You know, we should remember, you know, because of course we want the Congress to respond to the Supreme Court's decision and to update the formula for Section 5. But we should remember we had Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2012 when people stood on lines for 7 hours
right.
to vote, when the governor of Florida, you know, restricted early voting. You know, when you had the state legislator in Pennsylvania saying, you know, we have voter ID, so we'll be able to elect Romney. We understand that, you know, the Voting Rights Act is not even the be-all and end-all. And actually what the Supreme Court walked into with this decision was an already aroused public, not just African-Americans and Latinos, but already aroused public who saw what happened in 2012 and asked, you know, what to me is always the quintessential, you know, question that Fannie Lou Hamer asked so many decades ago, is this America? They walked into a very conscious America that something is wrong as it relates to voting when we actually have elected leaders who stand on a platform of trying to make it harder for people to vote. So actually, the seeds of movement were already aroused. When people stood on those lines for 7 hours, that was evidence of a movement. They were standing there because they recognized that there was an effort to suppress their vote, and they said, hell no. So I agree with you, and I'm not suggesting that the March on Washington that one day is what's going to do it. I'm saying it's already been happening. And as you can see from Moral Mondays in North Carolina, where you have a populist movement rising up against the takeover of the political power in that state by the right, when you see these young people, the Dream Defenders in the Florida State House, and one of our lawyers was just down there talking with them, and you know, it's extraordinary what they are trying to do. And they were really moved, frankly, by the verdict in the George Zimmerman case, beginning to draw the connections between the Stand Your Ground laws, the, you know, having the right to vote, the ALEC, the organization that writes many of these laws for the right. We're now in the moment where people are beginning to connect all the dots, all of the anti-woman legislation that was happening in Texas and the stand that Wendy Davis took. There is a movement happening. And, you know, we should recognize sometimes we get caught by the gaze of looking back at the civil rights movement, which,
right.
yes, was an historical period. But the movement for civil rights is an ongoing process. And you, Mark, because you've been in this a long time, you can kind of tell when we're on the crest of something, where people are beginning to put pieces together and come together. And I firmly believe that we are in the midst of a process. We haven't peaked yet, but we're getting there. People are making the connections. They're willing to be activists and put their feet on the line. They're willing to stand in the state house. They're willing to occupy. They're willing to be arrested. We're in a moment of tremendous activism. And all of those things have to come together, the legal strategy, the activism, the mobilization, and those people who can frame, can articulate for America the moment that we're in and the place that we're trying to go to.
Now, Cheryl Neifel, I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I know you have to run.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care. You too. And we're going to take a very brief break and come back. I do want to tackle this political question. And I want to pick up where Cherilyn left off. And where we left this conversation off, Ari, Michael, and Addison, which is what political movement, how do we connect the political movements in this country? What do you see, Ari, out there in America right now where people are resisting these Voting Rights Acts, what's happening with the Voting Rights Acts, and how those things may coalesce? Because clearly it's time for America to stand up. There's a great divide here, and this decision by the Supreme Court just, to me, signified that divide. And the question is, how do we overcome it? No pun intended, maybe there was. And we'll be right back with that, so stay with us.
Whisper, listen, whisper, say we're free. Rumors rhyme, must be lying, can it really be? Can't conceive it, can't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, slave no longer.
Welcome back. That was Abby Lincoln. This was the day that she was born. In 1930, and we will celebrate her through her song during the next couple of hours. We are still talking about the Voting Rights Act. I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Joining us are Addison Francois, Associate Professor of Law at Howard University School of Law, Michael Higginbotham, the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, and Ari Berman, contributing writer for The Nation magazine, investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, 410-319-8888. You can join us here, please, with your thoughts and ideas about where this takes us. And Ari, I'd like all three of you to jump here. Ari, you start. I mean, the question seems to me that I'm curious what you're seeing as movements bubbling up around the country, around voting rights acts, where these things are taking place, since you've been looking at the various states. Sherilyn talked about, you know, the what's going on in North Carolina. We've been covering that, about those kind of protests there, and the young people and people throughout Florida and Tallahassee standing up in that state. So what's happening? What movement are you seeing around voting rights actions in this country right now?
Well, I think in many ways, Mark, the voting rights movement was reborn in 2012. People realized that they needed to take a page from the 60s because voting rights were once again under attack, that we couldn't take our most basic right for granted. And so you had a wide range of groups from the NAACP to the League of Women Voters to the ACLU to more grassroots organizations really fight hard to make sure that either people had new voter IDs or they were challenging the laws in court or people knew when they could vote early and that they wouldn't leave if there were long lines or that they were going to work doubly hard to register voters in places like Florida where the courts had really tried to sort of protect the backlash against voting rights. And so, I mean, all of that happened in 2012, and it's continued into 2013. And so Sherilyn mentioned two examples, Moral Monday and Dream Defenders down in Florida.
Right.
Now, Dream Defenders is working more on Stand Your Ground, but they're very much borrowing a page from the civil rights movement in terms of having, they're on, I think, their 22nd day now of sitting in the Florida Capitol to demand the repeal of Stand Your Ground. And you look at Moral Monday in North Carolina, which is this multiracial, multi-issue, very socioeconomically diverse movement, basically fighting against what the legislature is doing down there. That whole movement started when North Carolina introduced this very harsh voting restriction bill. And that was really the impetus when Reverend Barber of the NAACP down there said that we have to go to the legislature and do a nonviolent pray-in, as he called it. And 17 people were arrested the first day, but the numbers just kept growing because people want to be involved in some way. They're outraged by what's happening, but they don't know what to do. And so when they see a movement, when they see people in the streets, when they see, hey, it's okay to get arrested, 90-year-olds are getting arrested now, more and more people are joining, and I'm meeting a lot of young people down there that have studied the civil rights movement that want to engage, that want to be part of a new civil rights movement. I think we're starting to see that right now.
Well, that is, I mean, to me, those are the encouraging things that we're seeing of Michael Higginbotham, and I think that one of the things that we don't see, because America doesn't report on these kind of protests taking place, in people don't realize sometimes that crossing state lines, people are fighting around the same issues, and we just get very isolated, which, by the way, as a sidebar, we are, while we're instituting this new program with Rose Aguilar on this radio program in a couple of weeks, to every week look at what's happening around the country so people don't feel so isolated and see what's going on. But Michael Higginbotham, what are your thoughts? I mean, not just as a law professor, but now someone who's observing how the society is moving.
I am very encouraged by the fact that you look at minority registration and voter participation over the last couple of years, and it has really increased. You look at what happened in 2008, 2012 in the presidential elections, and minority voter participation was up tremendously in terms of percentages. And to me, that's very encouraging. So when you think about a response to the limitations on voting practices, the response should be to participate even more and to try and overcome these barriers. So not only do, you know, we need to see people attempting to restrict the voter ID laws to make sure they're not passed in these states, to participate and attempt to restrict them from being passed. But then also, if they are passed, such as in Texas and in North Carolina, South Carolina, what we need to do is we then need to challenge these voter laws in the courts and in the legislators. So to me, it's very important to participate in the American constitutional democracy. The response to limitations should be more activism and more participation, because in the end, that will win out.
And Addison, on the way to the phones here, get your thoughts as well. Again, you know, I know you're a law professor, but what you're seeing beyond being a professor of law?
Well, let me answer the question by tying it to something that Cheryl said before she left, because she pointed out very specific instances of various movements taking place around the country. And I think that if, in fact, there is going to be such a movement, it cannot be about voting rights. It's not a voting rights movement anymore. Mm. It can even be about civil rights. It's not about that anymore. It seems to me what we need to do, and again, that picks up a little bit from what Cheryl said, is to reframe the narrative. This is really about fundamental human rights. The idea being that a citizen who is not able to vote and vote effectively in his or her country is being denied fundamental human dignity. And the reason I think it's important to basically appropriate that language is that the decision that the Supreme Court have ended up this term, particularly the one having to do with voting rights, is very interesting that Justice Roberts in particular has framed the decision in terms of state rights. And he's framed the decision in terms of state dignity. The idea being that if you have something like Section 5 in which the states have given preclearance from the federal government, it is an insult to the dignity of the state. I think if there's going to be a new movement, we have to think about it in perspective of to what extent is what's happening in this country, whether it's about, you know, voter ID laws, et cetera, to what extent is it an insult to the dignity of the human being in this country? And in that way, it seems to me, we can basically take voting rights and cast it in the larger narrative of what's going on around the country. Because I think the idea of simply casting it as a civil rights movement or even as a voting rights movement probably isn't going to work anymore. We have to find a new story, and the story has to be about fundamental human right and human dignity.
So let's go to the phones here. I'm going to kind of explore what you were saying, Addison, in the larger context. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we look at the 48th anniversary of the passing of the Voting Rights Act. And Leo in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo.
Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo.
How you doing?
Very well.
Okay, I think it's a great discussion. The voter ID laws must be challenged. They're undemocratic, and it's outrageous. But I want to call attention again to the state of Maryland and other places where the incumbents don't want new people to register to vote. We've got a political machine in this state, and I've said it before, that's been in office for 62 years, the Democratic political machine, and those folks don't want new voters in the system because if you have too many new voters, they might be upset. So we don't have term limits, and you cannot not address the issue of term limits versus what you're talking about, because there is such a thing as voter suppression, Mark. And voters are suppressed, they're apathetic, and they're not motivated to vote. By the virtue of the electronic machine process we have, you have no paper trail, so you don't know whether you can validate legitimately who voted and why. The majority of eligible voters in this country don't believe it will make a difference if they vote, and the consequences of that statistically is that the majority of eligible people to vote in this country don't vote in the United States because of the machine politics that exist here. So I just want to put that into the mix. I agree with fighting the voter ID laws, but you've got to also fight the institutionalized racism and the kinds of suppression that come from machine politics and the control of politics, whether they're Republicans or Democrats who control that machine. They don't want new people in the system. They do not want to bring institutional change in this country in the way that it ought to be. That's my opinion.
Leo, thanks so much. Ari, you have some thoughts when you're saying, even though it's a little Maryland-centric, you might have a thought on that. Ari? Did we lose touch with Ari?
I hear a lot of
bad buzzing on our line here.
I can hear you better now. How's
that? Oh, good, right. That's good, good. I thought maybe we lost you.
Okay. What I was going to say is that voting in and of itself is only the first step in terms of participation in a democracy. And that's why it's sad that we're having so much trouble just talking about voting, because really that's only the first step in the process. And so, unfortunately, we're moving backward in terms of the discussion that we need to have.
Mm-hmm.
We should be having a discussion about, okay, what happens after you vote? Do you have good candidates to vote for? Do you have a representative system where all people are being treated fairly? Do you have a system in which the candidate that wins the most votes wins office? Because we have a gerrymandering system now, for example, in North Carolina, where 51% of the votes went to Democratic U.S. House candidates, but Republicans retained 9 of 13 seats because of gerrymandering. It's hard to really see how you can call it a true democracy when something like that happens. So there's a lot of structural issues we have to address here. And one of the worry is that by just talking about the right to vote, we're missing all those other issues. On the other hand, by talking about the right to vote, it is in many ways an entryway into talking about all these other structural problems we have. We're not going to solve all of them. There's always going to be problems with incumbency, with too much money in the system, with politicians manipulating the rules to benefit themselves. That's always going to be true. But I do think that we're in a moment now where people are aware of how politicians are manipulating the political process, where people are aware of those structural obstacles, and now they're more willing to do something about it.
Because in a very kind of macro political level, Michael Higginbotham, when you look at the states that are kind of passing these voting restrictions, like Florida, Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, just those five, because they are battleground states in any presidential election, and you already see that people are. That there's a voter apathy in America with fewer people voting this democracy than in any in the world. At the same time, where there was a leap were in communities of color, poor people, and young people that actually voted since 2008, but again getting kind of squashed down here. So this is becomes this is a multi-level battle, because you can see I can see how it can get worse before it gets better in terms of building a movement to make it better.
It is a multi-level battle, and that's why on this anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, it's so sad that we're discouraging voter participation. We're discouraging participation rather than encouraging. And that's what we should be doing. I mean, the Voting Rights Act was the most democratizing piece of legislation that we've ever passed. We need to continue to pass legislation to encourage people to participate, to have early voting, to have 3 and 4 day voting, to pass laws that make it easier for people to participate, not harder. And we want to be encouraging that participation in this democracy, not discouraging it. And that's what's so sad, because these voter ID laws, these other things that are being passed now, are discouraging people's participation.
And Addison, I kind of final thought from you before we have to move on.
The final thing that I would say is that, and I think this is something that most of your guests have alluded to already, at the end of the day, it is not really just about voting. It's about fundamental political representation. I mean, it helps to remember that our government is legitimate only to the extent that it exists with the consent of the governed. It is very, very difficult right now, looking at what's going on around the country, to say that the government that we have and that we continue to have, particularly around certain states, exists with the consent of those that the government proposed to govern. And that is the fundamental violation of human rights that currently exists in this country.
Now, I'll just leave you with this thought. There are people calling in. We can't get the calls now because it's too late in our program. We have to move on to our next guest coming in from the world of Native American world to talk about Trayvon Martin and their views on that. But I'll just leave you this thought, because people are calling in saying they want voter ID laws. Let me leave you with this. That this came from Mother Jones Magazine. Between 2000 and 2010, there were 649 million votes cast in American elections. There were 47,000 UFO sightings, 441 Americans killed by lightning, and only 13 credible cases of in-person voter impersonation. Leave you with that. I want to thank our guests here this hour, Sherilyn Ifill, who joined us earlier, the new president and director of counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Addison Francois, who is associate professor of law at the Howard University School of Law, and Michael Higginbotham, the Wilson H. Elkins professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghosts of Jim Crow and Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, Ari Berman, contributing writer for Nation magazine, investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute. And you also have a new book coming out, don't you, Ari?
Well, I'm writing a history of voting rights now, but it's not going to be out until 2015 on the 50th anniversary.
Well, we certainly won't wait that long to have you back.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll take a brief break and come right back.